A good morning to you. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva today, Friday the 26th of June, for this press briefing. Apologies for the delay. We had to resolve some technical issues. As always, we have an important agenda for you. Dominating the agenda today is a situation in Venezuela, the earthquake, the aftermath, and the recovery efforts. I should start off maybe just to remind you that we did share with you last night a statement on behalf of the Secretary General, through which the Secretary General expresses that he's deeply saddened by the loss of life and widespread destruction caused by the devastating earthquakes that struck Venezuela yesterday. This is the day before yesterday. He extends his sincere condolences to the families of the victims and wishes a speedy recovery to those injured. And of course, the Secretary General expresses his solidarity with the people and government of Venezuela. So we have a number of briefers. We'll start off immediately with Jens from OCHA, and then we'll go down the line with UNHCR, IFRC, WHO, and IOM. So starting off with Jens, over to you.
Thank you, Roland. Good morning, everyone. I have a brief operational update that I just received that I'll give you in a minute. But let me first say that earthquake is one of the most devastating things that can happen to any country. It really is a terrifying thing. But what we are seeing right now is also an international mobilization at its very best. It is, I think, in our troubled world, an impulse, a very human impulse to help that we are seeing. And the numbers bear that out. The entire humanitarian system is moving very fast and at scale, supporting the government-led response in Venezuela. Top priority, search and rescue. Of course, our thoughts are with the survivors, and I would say particularly with those who do not know if their loved ones are dead or alive in the rubble. So search and rescue is the top thing that needs to be done very fast. There has been a vast mobilization through the International Search and Rescue Advisory Group network. That is a network that mobilizes national teams from across the world who have been trained and certified to do these kind of urban search and rescue operations that are so desperately needed in Venezuela right now. We have a total of 25 teams, both search and rescues and medical teams from across the world deploying with a total of 1,000 rescue personnel, with more to come. So of the 25 teams, 17 teams are urban search and rescue teams. They are classified. And I want to read out from the countries where they come from, because I think it's worth mentioning. They're from Switzerland, United States of America, the Netherlands, France, Qatar, the Czech Republic, Germany, Jordan, United Kingdom, Spain, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, and Italy. There are others that are being mobilized. The Swiss, the Americans, the Italians, the Colombians, and the Chilean urban search and rescue teams have already arrived in the country, along with other teams from El Salvador and Mexico. The other teams are arriving today and in the coming days, and they will begin operations immediately upon arrival. We have also mobilized what we call an UNDAC team, that's United Nations Disaster and assessment teams. They will support the response in Venezuela. There is also an additional four-member operational partner support team that is arriving in Caracas as I speak. We have, of course, a number of OCHA staff who are also being deployed. I will send you a note with all these numbers, because there are many, but taken together, I think it bears out what I said, a very substantial initial response to what has happened in Venezuela. Thank you.
you very much, Jens, in testifying to this coordinated approach. Obviously, we have five briefers speaking to their agencies' activities in the country, so we're very pleased to have everyone here. First off, we'll turn to Matt of the UN Refugee Agency, and then afterwards we'll move to our colleagues in the field. Matt, over to you.
Thank you so much, Rollo, and good morning, everyone. Our briefing note has been shared with the press, or is in the process of being shared, and I will try and keep things quick, as I know there are many other people briefing today. Like our partner agencies, we've been scrambling staff and resources to respond to the effects of this devastating earthquake that struck late on Wednesday. As we heard from Jens, the government's response is still, of course, focused on search and rescue, medical care and damage assessments. We, the UN Refugee Agency, are ready to support this response with partners, and we're mobilizing our assistance, triaging available supplies to meet the emergency needs. Damage has been reported, of course, to many, many homes and essential public infrastructure and services, including, we understand, 8 hospitals, with assessments still ongoing. As the lead of the Humanitarian Protection Cluster and the co-lead of the Shelter Group, we're ready to support the authorities with additional resources as needed. At the end of last year, Venezuela itself hosted well over 200,000 refugees, asylum seekers, and others of concern to UNHCR. And the impact of the quakes looks likely to significantly exacerbate the existing protection risks for these vulnerable groups and other civilians. We're particularly concerned at the moment, of course, about the impact on returnees who were already facing many challenges to reintegrate even before this disaster. Some of these risks include around personal security, inadequate or unsafe housing, a risk of exposure to violence for women and children, loss of documentation, and of course, reduced access to healthcare, water, education, and livelihood opportunities. We do have, like our partners, pre-positioned core relief items for quick distribution across the country, and our emergency teams are on standby to deploy as needed, including technical experts. Tragically, authorities in La Guaira reported the collapse of a temporary accommodation center hosting around 140 returnees who had recently arrived on a flight from the United States. We've had a presence in the country since 1991, and we are currently have staff in offices in Caracas, Maracaibo, and San Cristobal. All of our staff members have been accounted for and are safe. For the country, we had a requirement of some $45 million for this year, which was only 11% funded before the earthquake. Obviously, the needs will rise significantly, and timely and flexible support is urgently required now more than ever. Very quick word for you finally on Venezuelans living abroad. At the end of last year, there were some 6.9 million Venezuelan refugees and migrants hosted across the region, Latin America and the Caribbean, including 4 million in need of assistance. We conducted a survey in the spring, which found that around 1/3 had an intention of returning home. The primary motivation cited was family reunification. At this stage of the emergency response, of course, it's far too early to assess the potential impact on returns. The immediate priority, of course, remains search and rescue. We'll continue to support voluntary, informed, safe, and dignified returns when conditions allow that. And of course, a final word, we remain with our teams on standby to support as needed in the border areas, particularly Colombia, Brazil, and those other countries in the region that have welcomed Venezuelans who left the country in recent years. Thanks, Rollo. I'll hand it back to you there.
Thanks to you, Matt, very much. Okay, we'll return to the issue of the displaced with Zoe momentarily, but let's talk about IFRC now. We have on the line Lois Pace, who's IFRC's Regional Director for the Americas, who is joining us from Panama City. I realize it's very early in the morning there, Ms. Pace, so thank you very much for joining us. Over to you.
Thank you very much for having me. Yes, indeed, it is early here in Panama, and I send you warm greetings from where I sit, but also on behalf of my colleagues who are and have been really working around the clock in Venezuela. Of course, we're all aware of the devastating record-breaking events that did take place in Caracas and surrounding areas just about 36 hours ago. And our thoughts continue to be with everyone affected. I will focus on a few different areas. First off, I want to talk about the context in which this emergency has taken place. You know, these earthquakes and the constant aftershocks that they've brought obviously have not occurred in a vacuum or affected a blank slate in Venezuela. They affect communities that have already been enduring multiple pressures. So whether that's a strained health system, whether that involves individuals who have been on the move and returning home, some for the first time in decades, or whether you want to take into account the difficult climate season that we're entering, including the effects we're already seeing from El Nino. This has been exacerbated by multiple challenges. And after two nights, people are still terrified to re-enter what were their homes or other structures, and still finding themselves displaced. I also want to acknowledge what our colleague just shared around still the limited communications affecting the ability of families to be or remain connected, not to mention the services that we or others can provide. I want to also just spend a little bit of time talking about who is on the ground and on the front lines, and obviously acknowledge the first responders in this tragedy who have been Venezuelan and who have been working tirelessly again to really ensure that people survive or remain safe. I'm in particular most familiar with our Red Cross volunteers and the thousands of volunteers that stand on the shoulders of those who have served in Venezuela for 131 years. That's how long the Venezuelan Red Cross has been established and has held its special relationship with public authorities in the humanitarian space in Venezuela. They were in response mode within minutes, even though many of them had lost their own homes and weren't sure where their own families were. And that response has included standing alongside others in search and rescue efforts, but importantly, providing first aid, including psychological first aid, to those recovered. And in the initial hours, conducting needs and damage assessments in areas that had not yet been reached. And this is on even though their own national headquarters had stood damaged and was not necessarily accessible. I will also add that the Venezuelan Red Cross runs a national network of hospitals, clinics, and ambulance services that have been turned on and have been drawn on and remain fully operational, fortunately. And so that's helpful as health facilities overflow. And I know our colleague from PAHO will say more about health conditions. As for the International Federation of Red Cross, we obviously haven't waited in the first few hours of these events. We released 2 million Swiss francs from our Disaster Response Emergency Fund, or DREF. And actually today, we've launched an emergency appeal of 50 million Swiss francs to help, again, the Venezuela Red Cross assist a few hundred thousand people, 300,000 people with services like shelter, healthcare and safe water and hygiene, as well as some of that psychological support that I've mentioned. Even as I speak, we have our first 17 tons of humanitarian assistance leaving our logistics hub here in Panama for Venezuela. So that includes items like kitchen or sets, hygiene kits, mosquito nets, and other essential items that have been requested and that add to the supplies that had already been pre-positioned in country for other events or circumstances. I will close with a couple of other points. I'm really glad that it's been mentioned the diaspora, the Venezuelan diaspora, and the anxiety, not only in country, but of others outside the country who are worried about their loved ones. We have sister Red Cross societies throughout the region who have established special programs that we call Restoring Family Links that provide services for people living both inside and outside the country to receive news of those that that they love or about whom they might be worried. These include the countries of Ecuador and Colombia, as well as Argentina, Bolivia, Guatemala, Mexico, Costa Rica, Honduras, as well as Uruguay and Paraguay. So quite a set of those standing in solidarity with the Venezuelan Red Cross. I know we also speak a great deal about resilience and the fact that Venezuelans are continue to show that, but I have also been known to say that people shouldn't have to rely solely on resilience and rely solely on themselves. Of course, the response and the recovery will remain local if it's done right and well, but it needs to also involve those of us in the international space, and it's one of the reasons we are so heartened at the IFRC that there has been such a fulsome global response, and we call for that to continue, not just in the days and weeks to come, but in the months and unfortunately years to come. A few weeks ago, I was actually in Caracas with the Venezuelan Red Cross, receiving some of these planes of migrants and otherwise understanding their new Red Cross law and other in other areas. And I told them that we would continue to stand with them in times of uncertainty or strain. So that time is now, and I thank everyone who is really showing up and stepping up for those in Caracas and beyond. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Ms. Pace. I should also acknowledge Paolo is online from IFRC. So thank you very much again for joining us, Ms. Pace. Now I'm turning to Dr. Ciro Ugarte, who is the PAHO, Pan-American Health Organization, NWHO's Health Emergencies Director, joining us from Washington, also quite early there. Thank you very much. Christian is also online, but over to you, Dr. Ugarte, and thank you again.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. I would like to highlight the bravery and also all the capacity of the country to respond to this emergency. And highlighting that, I would like to also commend the people in Venezuela for all the response that they are doing, particularly in difficult situations. I would like to highlight that given the pre-existing fragility of the health system and the protective emergency in Venezuela, the shock from the two earthquakes on June 24th is driving significant additional needs for support, including medical supplies, trauma care, health facilities assessment, and difficult coordination because of the fragility of the communication system and also the access to difficult areas hit by the earthquakes. The number of deaths and injured people will significantly increase in the coming hours and days, and these figures will continue to evolve as search and rescue operation, patient care, and damage assessment continue. The Pan American Health Organization, the regional office of the World Health Organization, is working very closely with the Ministry of Health, the Civil Protection, and the Health Cluster with 70 partners. And we are convening partners supporting evaluation of health structures and mapping where partners are and how they can support and are supporting. And also engaging with regional counterparts on potential donation. We have received formal support from at least 15 ministries of health, and several of them are ready to deploy their teams, their health teams, to Venezuela. At this moment, the overriding priority is to urgently provide life-saving health care and rescue as many people as possible, because the first hours, as you know, are critical to saving lives, and also the efforts are heavily focused on ensuring timely medical care in the moments of low availability of healthcare workers, but also health facilities and supplies. And the immediate health priorities include also mass casualty management, trauma care, particularly in the areas with collapsed buildings and ongoing search and rescue operations. And hospitals are managing injuries such as broken bones and head injuries, but also we are seeing burns and other injuries that result from building collapse. And we're working in the assessment of the health facilities. In the previous years, we did an assessment of the using a tool that is the hospital safety index, that is the probability of a health facility to continue operating in emergencies. And with that, we mapped also all those health facilities with the mapping of the intensity of the earthquake. And we identified more than 90 hospitals that are exposed to intensities beyond 6 and 7 in the Mercalli modified standard. And in that regard, we are prioritizing those facilities, including the assessment of their structural safety, emergency department capacities, the operating theaters, inpatient beds, blood supply, the oxygen, et cetera. And also we are coordinating with the deployment of emergency medical teams. And one of them, the emergency medical team type 3 with surgical capacity, is being deployed from Samaritan Purse. And this will significantly expand hospital capacity on the ground, and it will be located in La Guaira. And this hospital has been already approved and accepted by the national authorities, so it is being deployed. Amidst this is also key to maintain critical services, including the care of the people that are in shelters, but also there are maternal and newborn cares, dialysis, chronic disease treatment, emergency surgery, mental health, and psychological support and disease surveillance that, of course, continue to be priority. There will be particular health challenges for people and shelters, and the national authorities are monitoring also for overcrowding for these priorities. So in this regards, we would like to highlight again the work of the national healthcare workers and the national response teams, because even with difficult situation with their own families in danger, they are still providing the healthcare. Over. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Doctor, and thank you for highlighting this important angle on the medical front. So over to you, Zoe, now.
Thank you very much. So I have a short statement from IOM. The earthquakes that struck Venezuela yesterday have left a devastating trail of destruction. Families have lost loved ones, livelihoods, and the safety of the places they once called home. Buildings have collapsed and critical infrastructure has been damaged, limiting access to basic services. On the basis of the best available population and damage projections, IOM estimates that up to 6.76 million people could be affected in Venezuela following these events. More nuanced estimates are forthcoming as new information emerges. This includes up to 2 million people in Caracas alone. First and foremost, our thoughts are with everyone affected by this tragedy. We extend our deepest condolences to those who have lost family and loved ones. Right now, every hour matters. The initial focus is on search and rescue, with international teams arriving to assist, as colleagues have outlined. While assessments continue to determine the full scale of the impact, it is already clear that displacement will increase as more communities are affected and people seek safety. IOM is scaling up our operations, and we have received huge support already from the public, donors, and our partners. We will work with the government as they assess the damage to communities and public services. We are working closely with United Nations and humanitarian partners to rapidly mobilize life-saving assistance. Our teams are preparing to provide emergency shelter, water, sanitation and hygiene support, health services, protection and essential relief supplies to displaced and affected communities. We have basic relief items pre-positioned in Caracas. They are being prepared for distribution in the areas with most severe need. We thank our private sector partners who have offered their support in the early days of this emergency and are on standby to assist with logistical and financial help. With thanks to our partners at Microsoft AI for Good Lab, we have received initial satellite mapping assessments indicating that 31.5% of buildings in Catia-Lamar are damaged. The immediate priorities are clear: emergency shelter, safe water, sanitation, healthcare, protection, and essential relief items for those who have lost everything. But the needs will not stop there. Recovery will require sustained support to help families rebuild their homes, restore livelihoods, and recover with dignity. The international community must act swiftly. Timely humanitarian support today will save lives, reduce suffering, and help communities begin the long road to recovery. IOM remains committed to working alongside our partners to deliver life-saving assistance and support the people of Venezuela through the difficult days and months ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Zoe. Lots of information to digest, very important indeed. So let's go to you, colleagues, for questions. And if you could highlight who you want to point your question to, Alexandre, AFP.
Yeah, thank you for this briefing, Alexandre Robois, AFP. I have one question for Mrs. Pace and one other for Jens, if it's possible. Mrs. Pence, we understand that the situation is quite critical in certain areas. Could you tell us what are the primary needs of those affected right now, as well as for the days and maybe the weeks to come, please? And second, for Jens, we understand that the 25 search and rescue and medical teams you mentioned are being sent by government. Do you have any idea of the total number of relief workers sent to Venezuela from abroad, including, for instance, those sent by NGOs? Thank you.
Thank you, Alexandre. Ms. Pace, over to you.
Thank you. I needed to request permission to unmute. Good question. The needs, the most immediate needs are somewhat varied, but as I mentioned, the health needs stand out for us. There are a number of individuals with injuries, as you can imagine, particularly as they're being recovered from the rubble. And so not only first aid, but trauma kits and care are essential in these still first hours and days. And I do not want to undersell the importance of that psychological first aid and mental health care that I mentioned as well. It is a service that is integrated into the health provisions that are a part of the Venezuela Red Cross programs at hospitals and clinics, and is just as in high demand as those services requiring physical care. I think the other piece is just around sort of daily living. So whether it's having those personal hygiene kits, having access to food and water, I mean, people left everything and nothing is functioning as it should or as it has in these areas. And so just ensuring that people can literally survive with those essentials is our priority on the ground.
Yeah, thank you. It's a great and very important question. And the short one answer is no. We do not have a full overview of everybody coming in. That will be for the Venezuelan authorities. We are not the ones giving visas. So the numbers that we have are for those that are coordinated through our mechanisms. Thank you.
Thank you both. For the questions in the room, perhaps? No, let's then turn online. We have a few. Bianca, Globo TV.
Hi, Rolando. Thanks a lot. Matthew mentioned that your team is on standby to support other countries in the region. Have you received any requests from Brazil? Sorry, I forgot to tell you. Bianca Routier, Brazilian journalist. I work for Globo TV Brazil. So do you have any information from the ground regarding Brazil? What kind of support might be needed? And also, Matthew and Dr. Ugarte, you both said that the real number of victims could be much higher than the official figures. Could you please, I mean, the figures that we have right now, could you please give us an idea of the scale? Are we talking about hundreds or thousands of deaths. And how confident are you in the official figures released so far? If I can add a last one for Jens, the UN Human Rights Mission in Venezuela urged the government to lift restrictions on social media. I would like to understand how serious are these restrictions at the moment, how much these restrictions can affect access to information during the rescue efforts. Maybe I don't know if the if there is someone from the Human Rights Office also there, maybe could add. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Okay, let's start off with Matt on the Brazil request, if there was one. Go ahead, Matt.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So I'm not aware of any formal request as of yet by the authorities in Brazil for us to support there. But having said that, of course, we stand ready to do so if and when asked. And in terms of our footprint in the country, as you well know, Brazil, of course, shares a vast northern border with Venezuela, primarily in the state of Roraima. And over the most recent years, we have been working very closely with the authorities in Brazil to support those who have crossed the border, and also to help with relocation of those who have come into the country from Venezuela. And then, you know, within Brazil, helping with documentation and status recognition of those who have arrived. And, you know, a similar approach, we would say, in the case of Colombia, of course, which has had a massive regularization effort in regards to Venezuelans who have arrived there, and similarly with the border reception and legal support. And also countries a bit further afield, so Peru and Ecuador, which both host significant numbers of Venezuelans, we have a similar footprint there. So, of course, ready to support the authorities as and when needed. In terms of the numbers of victims, I wouldn't go into that too much, except to say we have had reports already this morning that, of course, the numbers are rising against last night. I wouldn't get into the realm of speculating about how high they will go, but of course it's extremely worrying what we've seen so far, and our deepest condolences and thoughts go out to the families and loved ones of all those who have been impacted, both within the country but also in those neighboring countries as well. Thanks. Let me leave it there, Rolo. Back to you.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Of course, we echo the sentiments, and it is difficult, colleagues, to obviously assess scale of casualties, but maybe Dr. Ugarte, I don't know if there's anything more. You also referred to that. I'm not sure if there's anything more you wanted to add. Dr. Ugarte? Yep, okay. Go ahead.
Yes. Yes. It is very difficult for all the teams, and particularly with the health sector, to provide a real assessment of the situation. The communication and access to the places and to the health facilities is not easy. We have been struggling to reach all those health facilities. We deploy teams to do the assessment. So in that regard, measuring what is the number of deaths and injuries would be very difficult. But according to the assessment, previous assessment, and also all the figures that we have and the coordination that we have with the partners, we are following the number of deaths, probably would be in the hundreds, and the injuries in the thousands. And the difficult situation that we are seeing is the access to healthcare facilities. But because of that, we do damage and needs assessment even before looking at the health facilities. And I would like to highlight this important pre-existing information that is helping us to prioritize. For example, 20 emergency hospitals were exposed to intensities with 7 or above. That means that at least 20 health facilities are in an extremely difficult situation and most probably are severely damaged or impacted by the emergency. And in those health facilities are located particularly in La Guaira, in the capital district of Caracas, in Miranda, Aragua, Carabobo, Falcón, Zulia, Yaracuy, and Lara. And also, I would like to highlight the availability of health teams, emergency medical teams that are being ready to deploy. Five are being ready to deploy from the USA, Dominican Republic, Colombia, Switzerland, and Barbados. And also we have 7 emergency medical teams on standby. So in that regards, we are working very closely with the national authorities and the partners to reach the actual figures, but prioritizing the emergency health care and ensuring that the health facilities are provided the essential care that the people need. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Dr. Ugarte. Bianca, on your last question on the lifting of restrictions on communications, this was actually a recommendation from the fact-finding mission on Venezuela, that fact-finding mission set up by the Human Rights Council. So perhaps you could check with them to specify what exactly they want for that. And of course, if there's anything more that the Human Rights Office could add at a later point, we'll definitely get that to you, or maybe you can reach out directly to them. But indeed, these are important human rights angles to this crisis that we're contending with. So let's take another question. Antonio Efe, Spanish News Agency.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so, well, I think you already told about what are the main needs, but to put the question in another way, what the Venezuelan government, in the contacts you have with them, what are they asking about? What they need the most? And also, I don't know if you mentioned, because my connection cut for some minutes, are you planning any of the agencies to launch any special appeal for assistance? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So the question, if I understood correctly, what is the government asking for? That if I understood that correctly, I'm not sure who's best placed, I suppose. Maybe colleagues closest to the situation on the ground. Maybe either Dr. Ugarte, then maybe Jens can chime in afterwards.
Yes, of course. The national authorities are requesting us to do a proper assessment of the health facilities. So we do have people on the ground, but also we are deploying additional specialists on engineering, architecture, damage and risk assessment, and also the deployment of emergency medical teams. The government specifically requested the deployment of 3 emergency medical teams with surgical capacity to Venezuela. So as I mentioned, they are on standby and to be deployed. One of them is already being deployed. It's Samaritan Purse from the U.S. And also they have requested additional supplies, medicine, and equipment. And that list is being looked at the global depots, and we are already purchasing some of those kits, emergency kits, to be deployed to Caracas, even directly or through Panama. So the regional emergency depot reserve that we have in Panama has been activated, and we are deploying all we have according to the request of the government. There are at least 42 partners that are on the ground, and they are also supporting the areas that have been most impacted by the earthquake. So we will have launch an appeal. We're finalizing all the critical needs that the health sector is asking for, and according to the previous situation, also to complement. Fortunately, some of the donors, including the European Commission, already approved a modification of the current support that they are giving to Venezuela, so we can activate the existing funds to respond to the emergency. Over.
Thank you, Dr. Ugarte. Ms. Pace, is there anything you wanted to add from IFRC's perspective?
you for coming back to me. Yes, I think I was actually just trying to pull up some of the information we have of from our Venezuelan Red Cross, around their conversations with the government. I know that the government has been focused largely on search and rescue for obvious reasons, including the need for equipment to clear rubble. But as Dr. Ugarte said, they also have obviously other needs, whether in the health sector, whether with regards to shelter and materials and the like. And so I'm sure some of our colleagues will be able to follow up around that. But I think the important point of this is twofold. One is that the government is responsive and engaged willing and waiting for support from the international community. And so I can only speak for our Red Cross relationship, but in our new Red Cross law, we have embedded in that law some specifics around coordination, obviously, with us, as well as the sort of roles of the international community when it comes to meeting the needs of the government and the government articulating those needs. And so I think it's a good question. I also heard the question around pledges, and I appreciate the connections being lost. So thank you for asking for us to repeat that. So we at the IFRC have launched a call to action or an emergency appeal of 50 million Swiss francs, covering a number of areas, and we are happy to provide that information online, a link to that appeal as it's published. But that would cover 300,000, we estimate 300,000 Venezuelans with those programs and services. Thank you.
Thanks to you, Ms. Pace.
No, just to add that Emergency Relief Coordinator released $15 million from the Central Emergency Response Fund yesterday for the Venezuela response.
Thanks for that additional note, Jens. Okay, let's take a couple more questions. John Zarakostas, The Lancet, and Franz von Katz. John.
Yes, good morning. My question is to Ms. Pace and also to Mr. Ugarte from PAHO. I was wondering if the US Treasury waiver on sanctions, do you have clarity now what items you can deal with without having any complications? That would be very helpful. And secondly, Mr. Ugarte, you mentioned the health system had pre-existing fragility. Does that mean that the sanctions have had a huge impact on the health system still?
Okay, who wants to start? Maybe Ms. Pace, go ahead first, and then we'll go to Dr.
Yes, I'm happy to start. I appreciate this question very much, and we actually had a conversation with our teams yesterday about the flow of resources. This is obviously not just a consideration in light of the recent earthquakes and aftershocks, but all throughout the year, particularly beginning in January. We have, I will say, we have seen an improvement in the flow of goods and funding, and we ourselves have not faced significant challenges, particularly in light of some of the opening or loosening of those restrictions. One of the challenges, if I can call it that, is around actually everyone sort of being accustomed to the new reality and some of the new guidance or policies. And so I think seeking clarity from all involved, including from the government of Venezuela, as well as other actors or stakeholders, is probably what is required. And it's yet another conversation that's important when it comes to the laws and regulations for humanitarians, right? This is not just a Venezuelan issue, but a global issue. So for what it's worth, we're confident we can continue to work smoothly. I think it's partly because of our special relationship with the government, an official relationship with the government as an auxiliary to those humanitarian public authorities. It perhaps is facilitated. But again, thank you for highlighting this.
Thank you. Dr. Ugarte.
Yes, from our side, we have been working on the critical support that the health sector needs in Venezuela. And in that regard, we have been also being provided all the emergency and urgent supplies for healthcare workers. And this is something that has been done in the previous years, even with all the situation that you know very well. And this is closely coordinated also with the US and several other institutions that are part of the support for Venezuela. So currently there is no restriction for humanitarian support, but still, for example, in the last few weeks, Venezuela was able to pay the revolving fund for vaccines. So there is now availability to provide vaccines and essential supplies to Venezuela. In that regard, that is an avenue that we are looking for. And especially we already identified critical medicines, supplies, and equipment that have been needed in the health sector in Venezuela, and that has been expedited for this emergency. The issue now, the main issue, is the logistics and the availability of those supplies to be readily deployed to Venezuela. Over.
Thank you, Dr. Ugarte. We'll take one final question, and also Marta of the Human Rights Office has joined us. I think you have some information on Bianca's previous question, but I'll go to you, Bianca. Maybe you have a follow-up or another question entirely. Go ahead, Bianca.
Thanks. It would be great if Marta could talk about the restrictions, how these restrictions are currently in Venezuela and how it could affect the efforts for the rescue. And also just to add like a follow-up on Brazil for the UNHCR and IOM, because of the earthquake, do you have any idea of how many people could cross into Brazil to seek help? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Maybe we'll go back to you, Matt, and then maybe Zoe has something.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's way too early to speculate about, you know, potential movements in any direction, one way or the other, related to this crisis for Brazil or for any other country. But of course, to reiterate the message that I said earlier, you know, we do have a deep footprint in the region, and we are ready to support all of those governments in the region in the event that there are decisions to move. As I said earlier, any movement back towards Venezuela would, our position would be unchanged in that must be a voluntary movement. And if there is any decision to move in the opposite direction, of course, we would ask all of those countries in the region, as they have done for so many years, to continue to support Venezuelans who are on the move. Thanks, Rollo.
Thank you very much. And just to echo that, it really is too early to say, but obviously we are monitoring closely. Thank you.
Indeed. This is a developing story. We will keep you sharply focused with thanks to our briefers here. But I think maybe before we wrap it up entirely, I think, Marta, you wanted to add something to Bianca's previous question.
Yes, hello, Rolando. Thank you, Bianca, for your question. Of course, freedom of information is always paramount, and mostly so in situations like that where access to information can save lives. And we have documented that, yeah, pre-existing restrictions to the internet stay in place during the first few hours after the earthquake. And of course, we call, as we've called before, to adopt measures to safeguard the digital space and guarantee the right to information and freedom of expression and access to digital media in Venezuela. And allow me this opportunity to recall that we just published our latest report on Venezuela, that the High Commissioner will present it this afternoon. And in it, there's detailed information that I can share with you, with everyone, about the arbitrary arbitrary blocking of at least 85 websites, both by public and private internet services providers, and blocks to 39 media outlets, media platforms. There's a very specific detailed information in the report that you can access or we can share with you. And again, I repeat, the High Commissioner will present the report this afternoon. Thank you.
Okay, it's rather timely. Thank you, of course, colleagues, to consult their report if you want to fold in those details. Thanks to all briefers here, particularly thanks to our colleagues from Panama City and Washington, Ms. Pace and Dr. Ugarte, very much. I know it's early there, and I'm sure we'll be hearing from your agencies in the days to come. And thank you very much for the important work you're doing. Thank you very much, colleagues, for briefing again. Marta, if you want to scoot over next to me here, and you're staying on the podium because you have an item to brief our colleagues on, U.S. Deaths in ICE detention. So back to you to address this issue. Thank you. Sure. Okay.
So good morning to all. I think I didn't say it before. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, today urged prompt action to prevent further loss of life in ICE custody and called for independent investigations into all deaths under ICE custody. It is alarming that according to US government official data, in the first 5 months of this year, 18 people died in ICE detention. A further case of death in ICE custody has been reported this month. In 2025, a total of 33 deaths were registered, compared with 11 in 2024. The lack of transparency and clarity surrounding the circumstances of these deaths undermines accountability for them. The High Commissioner calls for prompt, independent, impartial, and effective investigations into all deaths in ICE custody. Those responsible for violations of the law must be held to account, and the rights of the victims' families to truth, justice, and reparations, and to guarantees of non-recurrence must be upheld. These deaths occurred in a context of broad expansion of the US immigration detention system. According to the latest official data, ICE currently holds over 60,000 individuals compared to approximately 40,000 in early 2025. There are plans to further increase the detention capacity up to 90,000 people by the end of 2026. Detainees, who include entire families with children and medically vulnerable people, are frequently reported to face inhuman conditions of detention and treatment, including inadequate health care and food, and exposure to disease outbreaks in overcrowded facilities. There have been concerning allegations regarding the use of force. Additionally, 5 of the officially reported deaths in 2026 were classified as suicides. A lack of information regarding the whereabouts of detainees during transfer has been reported, causing significant distress among families. In addition, prolonged uncertainty surrounding legal status and processes contributes to psychological distress among detainees. Turk also expressed alarm over the reported use of solitary confinement, which should be an exceptional measure, and when prolonged or indefinite, could amount to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. These factors exacerbate vulnerability and raise serious concerns as to whether some of these deaths in ICE custody could have been prevented. Alternatives to detention should be prioritized. Immigration detention should be an exceptional measure of last resort and should generally be avoided for people with significant medical or mental health conditions, as well as pregnant women. Regardless of their immigration status or that of their parents, children should not be subjected to immigration detention. U.S. immigration authorities must ensure that their detention facilities comply with international human rights norms and standards. This includes upholding dignity, avoiding overcrowding, providing timely access to health care, including mental health services, family notification, consular assistance, legal representation, and necessary interpretation services for all individuals in immigration detention. The High Commissioner urged the full restoration and strengthening of independent oversight mechanisms for immigration detention, highlighting their importance as a key safeguard against abuse. He also stressed the crucial role of congressional bodies in overseeing immigration enforcement practices and associated public funding to ensure better compliance with international human rights law. Turk strongly denounced the continued dehumanization and criminalization of migrants and refugees. Turk emphasized that no one should be sent back to a place where they could be Turk emphasized that no one should be sent back to a place where they could face serious human rights violations or other irreversible harm. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marta. Let's see if we have questions for you in the room, online. I don't see that's the case. I think you're very clear, and I note that this statement was also shared with colleagues earlier. So thank you very much, Marta, for highlighting this important story. Moving to a different subject entirely, very pleased to have with us Claire on the podium here with John Kennedy, who's WMO's head of climate information. I don't know, Claire, did you want to start off, or go ahead?
Yes, I'm very glad that this room is nice and is nice and cool. extreme heat, a widespread, intense late June heat wave in Europe, as you all know, as you're all feeling, has shattered numerous temperature records. It's having major impacts on human health, on ecosystems, on agriculture, on labor productivity, and it's accompanied in some areas, in particular France, by worsening drought and the risk of wildfires, as well as localized storms. The World Meteorological Organization, its partners, its members, the National Meteorological and Hydrological Services, are, you know, really mobilizing against this extreme heat in Europe. There's lots of early warnings, many red heat alerts, red being the top tier in the warning scale. And we're supporting coordinated heat health action plans to try to save lives. As always, that's the top priority, and to minimize the, you know, decisions, and to inform decisions to minimize economic damage and the very real disruption that we're seeing. My colleague John will talk more about the meteorological and the climate conditions behind this heat wave. It moved up from the Iberian Peninsula. The focus is now shifting, and WMO, we have a network of regional climate monitoring centers in Europe. One of them is operated by the German Weather Service, the Deutsche Wetterdienst. And in its latest climate watch advisory, it says that the heat wave will spread over large parts of Western, Central, and Southern Europe by the end of this month, and will increasingly shift towards the Central Europe and the Balkan area. Temperatures are expected to be, between 3 degrees Celsius up to 10 degrees Celsius for this time of year. And just to remind you, we're in June. You know, we are in June. We're seeing heat levels which would be more typical of late July, of August. We're doing a constantly updated story on our website with the new records, and at one stage yesterday I did think we wouldn't be able to keep up with all the records. Just to give you a snapshot, France. France recorded its hottest day on record on the 24th of June with an average national temperature of 30 degrees Celsius. Temperatures rose up to 43.8 degrees Celsius in one town in western France. And overnight temperatures, and these are important because this is where you have the real impact on health, on human health. If temperatures overnight, you know, don't drop beyond below a certain level, overnight temperatures in France also been setting new national records. One of them was 22 degrees Celsius. If you look at the map today, France is just a big blob of red. A large part of the country is under maximum level red alert. Spain recorded its hottest June days on record, 23rd and 24th of June. The United Kingdom broke the June temperature record for three consecutive days this week, with 36.4 degrees recorded in southern England yesterday, the 25th of June. And the UK's Met Office has issued red warnings for extreme heat on three consecutive days. And this is the first time ever under the current weather alerting system that it's done that for three straight days. UK also saw, you know, daily temperature records in May broken as well. Germany today is under widespread red warnings, including, you know, major cities, Frankfurt, Cologne. In Switzerland, closer to home, the northern city of Basel set a national new June record temperature yesterday of 38 degrees Celsius. Geneva is expected to get a little bit toasty this weekend, according to Meteo Suisse. And in the Netherlands, the Dutch National Meteorological Service has issued an unprecedented red alert for extreme heat for eight provinces today. And again, in the Netherlands, as in Belgium and Luxembourg, there have been a number of new either monthly or station temperature records. We need to get used to it, unfortunately. And I now pass over to my colleague, John Kennedy, who is head of climate information. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Claire, and hello, everyone. So why is this happening? Well, a number of factors have to come together for temperatures to reach the record extremes that we've been seeing over the past few days. First and most obviously, it's summer. Although June is not on average the warmest month, we're only a few days now after the summer solstice when the sun is highest in the sky and the days are longest. We have a classic omega blocking pattern where high pressure over the continent is flanked by low pressure systems, looking somewhat like the Greek letter omega. And together, these pressure systems funnel hot air from North Africa north over the western parts of the region. Under the high pressure, also in the middle of that omega block, the air is descending. It's piling up above the continent. And as it descends, it both warms and hinders the formation of clouds. And less cloud means that more sunshine can get in, further increasing temperatures. Now, these kinds of blocks can stay in place for days or even weeks. And the persistence of the block means that the heat can build day upon day and, crucially, for the impacts, night upon night. So light winds under the broad stationary high pressure mean that there's limited mixing of the air, allowing further heat to accumulate, and also means there's limited movements of weather systems and weather fronts that can bring cooler air from the outside. So we've seen all these factors in earlier heat waves, but they weren't as hot as the record-breaking conditions we're currently experiencing. So what's the difference? Now, no two heat waves are exactly the same, but say in the 50 years since the historic heat wave in 1976, Europe as a whole has warmed by around 2 degrees Celsius. It's one of the fastest warming continents, and extremes of temperature have increased too. The IPCC's sixth assessment report showed that hot extremes have increased in frequency and intensity over most of the world's land surface, and across Europe, there is high confidence there is a human contribution to that observed warming. Heat waves like this are what we expect to see in a changing climate. An extreme heat will occur more frequently, for longer duration, and with greater intensity as global warming continues. The high temperatures we're seeing during the day get much of the attention, but nighttime temperatures are exceptionally high too. When temperatures stay above 20 degrees Celsius overnight, as we've seen recently, and as Claire mentioned, residences can't shed the excess heat, and that exposes people to dangerous indoor conditions. In such conditions, the body can't recover from the heat of the day, and sustained across multiple days, this unrelieved strain is what drives excess deaths like we've seen in previous heat waves. These problems can be particularly exacerbated in urban areas where temperatures, particularly at night, are higher due to the built environment. Now, the clear skies don't just mean higher temperatures, they also mean a lack of rain, so there's a risk of drought, as Claire again mentioned, and as vegetation dries out, an increased risk of wildfires. These high temperatures and low rainfall have impacts across multiple sectors and can affect vital infrastructure, such as transport and power generation. A dry soil, as well as having impacts on agriculture, can also be a key factor in the formation of subsequent heat waves because dry soil warms more quickly than wet soil. It can also exacerbate flooding as dry soil is unable to absorb quick accumulations of rain. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kennedy. Do we have questions for our colleagues from... Yes, Alexandre, over to you.
Yes, thank you very much for this briefing. I have a very simple question. Given that records have been broken in several countries, can we say now that this phenomenon is a record-breaking heat wave of the European continent, either for the month of June or maybe in January?
I think when you say record-breaking heat wave, there's no specific definition of heat wave. This is the difficulty for saying in a kind of blanket sense. We can say locally that records have been broken in particular places, and like for France, the whole country has seen its warmest day on record. So records are definitely breaking. This is a record-breaking heat wave in many ways, but not in every single way.
In certain countries, such as France, you know, it's fair to use the term record-breaking heat wave. But if you look back last year, we also had record-breaking heat waves, but that was in a different part of Europe than it was Scandinavia. So, and we're still in the middle of it. It's unusual. It's not exceptional. We've had previous heat waves like this in June, but as I said, we're still in the middle of it. It is now going to shift, across Central Europe to the Balkans. So it's possible that at the end of summer, you know, we can look back and say, yes, you know, it was a record-breaking heat wave, but it's still very much in progress.
Well noted. Thank you so much. I don't think there are further questions, so I'd like to thank you both very much for joining us here, continue to highlight this continuing story, I should say. Okay, now I turn to our colleague who's joining us from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, David Stevenson, who's WFP's country director. Mr. Stevenson, thank you very much, and apologies for the delay. It's been a long briefing, but over to you, for your brief. Thank you.
Well, thanks to you, and thank you very much for your interest in our challenges and our efforts here in DRC. Let me start with the bigger picture. Ebola is spreading in eastern DRC in the middle of one of the world's largest hunger crises. Across the country, 26.5 million people, almost one in four Congolese, do not have enough food. More than 3.6 million people are already facing emergency levels of hunger. And in North Kivu, South Kivu, Ituri, Tanganyika alone, nearly 10 million people are struggling to put food on the table. So this outbreak is not only a health emergency, it is a humanitarian crisis. And we will not contain it with medical measures alone. When people are hungry, when they have lost their livelihoods, or when markets stop functioning, they move. They move to find food, they move to find work, they move to find safety, and those movements can make it much harder to stop the virus. At the same time, active conflict is pushing people into affected health zones, and insecurity and access constraints are making it harder for humanitarian teams to reach the communities who need help most. I would like to give you just one example. Our frontline team recently met with Jack, an internally displaced father whose five-year-old daughter has died from Ebola. He had fled fighting in Bukavu and walked for days to reach Beni. He thought he had escaped the worst, and then his daughter developed a high fever and started bleeding from her ears. He rushed her to hospital, but she did not survive. And 2 weeks later, now his wife is still in an isolation center. WFP is providing hot meals so patients and contacts can stay under observation without having to leave to look for food. And Jack himself is now caring for 13 family members with WFP food assistance. But he asked us a very simple, actually a painful question. With all these children, this 1 month ration will only last 2 weeks. And after that, how am I supposed to feed them when I have no means to do so? So that is why food assistance is not separate from the Ebola response. It is part of the containment. It helps people stay in care. It helps contacts, those who've been associated with Ebola, remain under observation. It reduces the pressure on families to move, and it gives health teams, our courageous leaders on the front line, the time and space they need to do their work. We are also seeing the economic pressure build. In Bunia, the epicenter of the outbreak, families already hit by conflict, by displacement and hunger, are facing another shock. Border closures, movement restrictions, and trade disruptions linked to Ebola are driving up food and fuel prices. Now, WFP has moved very quickly. Since the outbreak began, we have provided more than 36,000 hot meals in Ebola treatment centers, take-home rations to 2,600 in North Kivu and in Ituri, and monthly food to 14,000 people in 10 quarantine villages in South Kivu affected by the outbreak. Our logistics teams and UNHAS flights have also been central to the wider response, moving more than 1,750 first responders and more than 300 metric tons of essential cargo so frontline operations can keep going in hard-to-reach areas. But we need to do more, and we need to do it faster, at scale, and with the resources required. We also need safe and sustained access. We need to stabilize food and livelihoods so people are not forced to move simply to survive. And we need timely, flexible funding to keep food assistance, supply chains, logistics, and aviation support running for as long as this crisis demands. So WFP now requires $72 million for our direct Ebola response and $206 million for emergency food assistance across Eastern Congo. For families like Jack, this is very real. Food helps keep people in care. Logistics keeps responders moving. And access is turning plans into action. If we move quickly now, we have a better chance of containing Ebola and preventing an already severe humanitarian crisis from getting worse. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much to you, Mr. Stevenson. Let's see if we have questions for you. Give it a minute. I don't see that's the case. On this note, I'd just like to thank you very much for obviously sharing Jack's story and obviously this critical angle to the Ebola response, which is an issue which we have been spotlighting here and will continue to do so. And thank you very much again, Mr. Stevenson, and for your patience as well. Appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, colleagues, joining me on the podium is David Hirsch, as you know, from ITU, who's got an announcement concerning Geneva Digital Week. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Rollo. Well, from 6 to 10 July, Geneva's place at the center of the digital world will be reinforced with Geneva Digital Week, which features three key international events on artificial intelligence and digital technologies. First will be the first UN General Assembly mandated global dialogue on AI governance, taking place from 6 to 7 July. The WSIS Forum, which extends through the entire week from the 6th to the 10th of July, and the AI for Good Global Summit, taking place from the 7th to the 10th of July. So a lot of overlaps there. We'll try to work you through all these events. These events are built on the principle that no one country can either seize the opportunities or solve the challenges that are presented by digital technologies. The events tie together international efforts to ensure that digital technologies, including AI, work for everyone, that everyone is included in determining the future of these technologies, and that nobody is left behind. And we have to recall that 2.2 billion people around the world remain offline and essentially locked out from the benefits of these digital technologies, including AI. Participants at these events include heads of state, UN heads, CEOs, civil society leaders, leading thinkers, the latest, of course, in AI technology, and even a few cultural icons. The events largely take place at PAL Expo, with the one detail on that being that WSIS Forum will open at ITU headquarters for Monday and Tuesday and then shift to PAL Expo for the remainder of the week. The programs for all three events are online, and we will have additional information to share. We ask you critically not to wait for that additional information before you do the critical step of registering for these events. Registration is open. I don't want to speak for Rolando, but certainly we all know by now that this is available via Indico, and it's also available to register via ITU. You could, in the time it takes me to finish this briefing, open up an email, put pressreg@itu.int in the address bar, pressreg@itu.int, leave a nice message in the subject, and put simply just attach a photo of your current valid UN ID, and we will do the rest. We insure you for that. The accreditation you receive will work for all three events. So one single media badge, unfortunately, it's just not your UN badge. It'll be the secondary. Once you do that, we also try to make it easy for you to pick up that badge. We're confirming that ITU will be available Friday, that's next Friday, 3rd July, full day for reporters to come by in the lobby and to pick up that badge. I would strongly recommend and encourage that that be done because PAL Expo Monday morning is going to be very busy and the events will stack up very early in the morning, as Rolo can attest to, and also seeking to information on ITU's headquarters being available for badge pickup Sunday afternoon for those reporters that have become accustomed to being in the neighborhood on Sunday afternoons. Beyond that, just a quick note on facilities. We'll have a press room available, working space for reporters. So for those of you that move over to PAL Expo, there'll be a full filing center. You'll have the comforts there that you need to do your work. Our media relations colleagues will be on hand. While activities are all still being scheduled, we do expect to have on Tuesday afternoon, that's the 7th of July, at 4 o'clock, a tour, a media tour of the summit facilities. Critically here, PAL Expo will be restructured after the AI dialogue from hosting primarily that event with some of the opening events of AI for Good to the transition to WSIS. So there'll be a change in the venue between Tuesday and Wednesday, and so it's our pleasure to walk reporters through that and to brief you on the upcoming activities.
Great. Thank you. You made my job easier, David. Thank you very much. Indeed, I have been appealing to you to register. Do so quickly. You've seen the media advisor reel shared with you once again yesterday. In addition to that, maybe just to highlight one thing that's coming preceding this global dialogue and the WSIS event and the global AI for Good events, there is an important report that will be made public on the 1st of July. That is a preliminary report of the Independent International Scientific Panel on Artificial Intelligence. The panel itself, as you probably know, was authorized by the General Assembly last August. There comprises of 40 experts who yield from different parts of the world and have lots of expertise on this important issue, which continues to dominate much of our lives, AI, that is. So we will share that report with you. If you're interested to learn more, do contact me or David, and then we'll make sure we can perhaps get that report to you in advance. So that is the 1st of July when the report will be launched at 11 a.m. That is New York time, so 5 p.m. our time. And again, do register for the AI dialogue, as David mentioned. So that covers that. If you have any questions for David on this event, housekeeping, logistics, I think it's pretty clear. He spelled it out very nicely. David, thank you very much. Yeah, you want to add something? No? Okay. In that note, let me just draw your attention to a couple other announcements, not related to this, but just as I mentioned at the onset of this briefing, do take a look at the statement from the Secretary General on Venezuela, which highlights a number of issues which you just heard from our colleagues about. Again, expressing solidarity and condolences to the government and victims of this horrific earthquakes in Venezuela. We'll continue to update you on developments thereon. We have a statement we will have a statement to share with you this afternoon. It's a Secretary General statement on the UN Charter. Today is UN Charter Day, ladies and gentlemen. So this is an important opportunity. 81 years ago is when the charter was signed in San Francisco. So there's an important occasion to mark this event. The Secretary General will deliver remarks at 10 a.m., approximately 10 a.m. New York time. So that's 4 o'clock our time. So we'll share that statement with you. Human Rights Council, as you well know, is still well underway. Lots of important reports being presented to the Human Rights Council at the Assembly Hall. Do consult the update from Pascal. And a couple of observances to highlight. Today is the International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Trafficking. We have a Secretary General's message to mark this occasion, through which Mr. Guterres notes that illicit drug trafficking is not a victimless crime. It inflicts profound harm on people and communities around the world while fueling violence, crime, and instability. So as we mark this day, let's recommit to the bold, innovative, and evidence-based solutions to this scourge demands. And tomorrow is another observance. It is the 2026 Micro, Small, and Medium-Sized Enterprise Day. That's the 27th of June, and there is a message that we shared with you as well, and the Secretary General notes as we celebrate the critical role by micro, small, medium-sized enterprises lifting up communities, sustaining families, and driving economic progress. So that message is available for you in multiple languages. That's it from me. Any questions? No? On that note, I wish you a nice afternoon, a good weekend, and see you here on Tuesday. Thank you.